This is the state of things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. 81-year-old Charles Ray Finch was released from prison in May after serving 43 years for a murder the court now says he did not commit. On a winter night in 1976, Richard Holloman was gunned down while closing up his country store just outside of Wilson, North Carolina. The only witness to the crime was his employee, Lester Floyd Jones. Eyewitness testimony, a lineup, and an autopsy report were enough to get Finch a life sentence. But they're also now the facts that set him free and back to his family.
We are overexcited. This is a joy. This is a miracle come true. And we're just glad to be part of this miracle. God has truly showed a miracle in our life. This is it.
That was Catherine Jones Bailey, the daughter of Charles Ray Finch. James E. Coleman is the lead attorney and the co-director of Duke University's Wrongful Convictions Clinic. He spent 15 years working on the case. Jim, welcome back to The State of Things.
Thank you.
And you were there the day that Charles Finch was released from prison. Tell us about that day.
I was. We had, that morning, we had been in federal court and the judge agreed that his conviction violated the Constitution. The state did not challenge that. The judge ordered that he be released immediately. We sat around at a restaurant in Raleigh trying to get the Department of Corrections to do the paperwork. And then eventually, later that afternoon, we drove to the prison and they wheeled Ray out in a chair with his family sort of across the lot. And my two students and Jamie Lau and I greeted him at the gate.
You could hear the emotion in his daughter's voice, and there was a lot of emotion for you all who had been working on his case for such a long time. Take us back to 2002. How did you first start working on this case?
Yeah, well, actually, the case began in 2001 when Ray sent a letter asking the what was in the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence to review his case. We had set that organization up to sort of be the administrative branch of UNC and Duke, and we took Ray's case, and then we met him the next year in prison. And from that moment when we interviewed him and he told us his story, you know, we believed that he sounded credible. And we set out to try to develop evidence that would show he was innocent.
So tell us about what struck you about the case from the start. What were some of the first red flags for you that this was worth looking into?
Yeah, well, one of the things that we do when we examine a case is to look for some of the factors that we know as a result of DNA are contributors to wrongful conviction. In Ray's case, a lot of those factors were present. There was a cross-racial eyewitness identification under circumstances where the witness would have been under a great deal of stress. There was a, so the eyewitness identification, the question was that credible? There was an autopsy report that said that the victim had died from a shotgun wound, but our review of the actual report didn't seem to support that. There was also indication of misconduct by the deputy who was responsible for putting Ray in a lineup in which he was dressed in a coat, and none of the other members of the lineup wore coats. So we thought that there was law enforcement misconduct, erroneous eyewitness identification, and then some of the other evidence that was used to bolster the eyewitness identification, we thought was manufactured.
I want to dig into the eyewitness identification piece of it because that is really interesting and led to a really dramatic moment in the courtroom. Take us into what you all discovered.
So it turned out that they took a photograph of the lineups, and there were three lineups, successive lineups. The eyewitness was shown one lineup. Ray was in it wearing a coat. Second lineup, the same people, same coat. And then a third lineup, same people, same coat. And so the question was, why would they have three lineups if he identified Ray as the perpetrator in the first lineup? No police department would take a chance that the witness might identify a different person in the second and certainly a third lineup. So the question was, what was the story about the lineup? We found a Xerox copy of the photographs that had been taken of the lineup, sort of black and white Xerox, faded Xerox copies we got from the defense lawyer. And we basically kept that a secret because our concern was that if the state knew that we had the photographs, then the deputy would likely lie about what happened. And so we didn't want to give him the chance to do that. We interviewed him without telling him that we knew that Ray was dressed in a coat in the lineups. And it was clear when we met him that he knew the lineups were a problem. So he started to volunteer information about the lineups. We expected he would lie. So the purpose of the interview was not to get the truth. It was to get him committed to a story. And he told us that the one thing that he made sure of was that Ray was not wearing a coat. And we knew that if he stuck to that story, we were going to be able to expose it as a lie.
So it turns out that an eyewitness that day had said that Ray was wearing a coat. So the deputy asked Ray to wear a coat when he was part of the eyewitness lineup.
Well, he didn't ask him to wear it. Ray was wearing a coat.
He was wearing it anyways.
When
okay.
they picked him up that night, and he just told him to keep it on.
Interesting. So this comes down to this question of Deputy Tony Owens, and he really is at the crux of a lot of things that went wrong. What
Correct.
Did you find out about him and the role that he played?
Well, he was central. He was the principal detective on the case. And at the very beginning, when he showed up at the crime scene, he started to ask questions about Ray. Before he talked to the eyewitness, before he knew anything about what had happened, he asked people who were kind of standing around watching if anybody had seen Ray Finch there that day. And one person said that he had seen Ray there, earlier before sunset. And based on that, Tony Owens sent out a call for the police to arrest Ray. And they arrested him, and he told them that Ray would be driving a blue Cadillac, which is a car he drove. They picked him up, took him down to the sheriff's department, and put him in the three lineups. So it was clear that Owens had already decided that Ray would be a suspect before he had any basis, could not have possibly had any basis to suspect that Ray was involved. He didn't interview Ray. He didn't ask him what he had been doing. He just simply put him in a lineup. He didn't interview any of the Ray's alibi witnesses. He had been playing cards downtown at the time of the homicide. He didn't interview any other aspect of the case. His whole thing was to get the eyewitness to identify Ray and then to make the rest of the evidence fit Ray. And that's what he did.
So there's clear evidence of officer misconduct. We have the eyewitness testimony issue. We have the fact that the eyewitness said that he was shot by a shotgun, even though the autopsy report says it was likely to, or we've discovered that he was probably shot by a handgun.
Correct. Although the autopsy report in three places said that the victim had died from a shotgun wound. So the autopsy report was falsified to be consistent with the eyewitness testimony. But when you read the report, it was clear that the wound was not made by a shotgun. And this is one of the instances in which we approached Dr. John Butts, who was the chief medical examiner in North Carolina, and asked him to review it. And we told him that, based on our review, it didn't appear that this was a shotgun wound. And he got back to us and he said he agreed. And in fact, he found the doctor who had done the autopsy who admitted that it was not a shotgun and that that was a mistake to call it a shotgun wound.
So we see all of this now, and people may wonder, why did it take so long? Why was Ray in prison mm-hmm. for more than 40 years? Can you answer that question?
Because the state officials who were responsible for addressing the issues that we were raising were indifferent. I don't think they cared one bit whether Ray was innocent or not. They didn't care that their case had fallen apart. You know, the original case against Ray was that he personally had killed the victim with a shotgun. By the time we, in 2013, by the time we went to court and had an evidentiary hearing, they were conceding that the victim did not die from a shotgun wound, therefore Ray could not have been the killer. Some unknown person with a handgun was the killer, and their whole theory was that Ray was present based on the eyewitness saying that he had identified him at the scene. So, you know, we went from Ray being the killer to Ray being an accomplice. And, you know, as the case was falling apart, I don't think any of the people who were in a position to do anything about it really cared.
We're going to continue this conversation in a moment and bring in some other guests, but we are talking with Jim Coleman. He's the co-director of Duke University's Wrongful Convictions Clinic, and he was key in the exoneration of Charles Ray Finch. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao in for Frank Stacio. We're talking today about exoneration. Charles Ray Finch was released from prison in May after serving 43 years for a murder he did not commit. We continue the conversation with his lawyer, James Coleman. He's co-director of the Wrongful Convictions Clinic at Duke University's Law School. And I want to start with another clip now of Charles Ray Finch's daughter, Catherine. She was 2 years old when he went into prison and was there on the day that he was released. And this is part of her reaction.
Every time I have ever went over my dad's case, I never saw that my dad did this. I know that this other man's family wanted some justice, but it just wasn't my dad. Right. So justice wasn't there. So they still didn't get justice. We all end up suffering.
That's a clip of Charles Ray Finch's daughter, Catherine, who was a toddler when her dad went to prison. That clip is courtesy of WNCN. I'm speaking with Charles Ray Finch's lawyer, James Coleman. So she raises this question of justice, and it has been a long road. Can you tell us about where things are with the case now?
Well, he has been exonerated. The United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit found that he was actually innocent. And Judge Boyle in the United States District Court found that the use of the eyewitness identification violated the Constitution, vacated his conviction, and the state 2 weeks later dismissed the charges against him. So he's free, but that means that now he begins the struggle of being free after 43 years in prison.
Does he get compensated by the state?
He doesn't automatically get compensation. If the governor grants a pardon of innocence, indicating that he was wrongfully convicted and is innocent, then he would be entitled to $50,000 a year per year in prison, up to $750,000. So that's going to be the first step, is to try to convince the governor to grant a pardon of innocence so that Ray can recover the $750,000.
A lot of times there's a lot of focus in reporting on the day of the release, the celebration, the first meal, but there's so many complicated things that happen after that. Can you give us a brief overview of the kinds of things that Charles will be going through now?
Well, it's different. Every case is different. But once the person has been released from prison, I mean, he's literally dumped out, and the state basically has no further concern about him. The person, if he has family, will stay with members of the family. The problem is that sometimes causes problems because they don't know each other. The person doesn't have skills that would allow him to get a job. And so basically he's sitting around without anything to do. Usually I think they need some type of counseling. Sometimes they abuse drugs and alcohol, kind of self-medicate. And there are no programs to deal with that for people who were wrongfully convicted. The governor has proposed a program for people who are actually guilty once they get out of prison, but nobody focuses on what happens to the exonerated person. And everybody just assumes that they go on with their life, and that's just not true.
We're talking with the lead attorney on the case of Charles Ray Finch, and I want to bring in another guest to the conversation now. This is Buncombe County District Attorney Todd M. Williams. He spent more than 10 years working as a public defender, and then he took the office of as Buncombe County's DA in 2015. He joins us from Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Todd, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you.
So we hear stories like this one of Charles Ray Finch, and we wonder how something like this can happen. I know you have more than a decade of experience as a public defender. Before you became the DA, can you give us some insight into why a case with such substantial flaws would make it to trial? And today, your role as a DA in catching these kind of mistakes so they don't happen?
Well, I think we're kind of looking back through a paradigm shift that's occurred in our criminal justice system. Going all the way back to 1973, there's an entirely different, I guess, perspective on justice. And there's been a number of modifications procedurally in the criminal justice system to ensure that, in the modern day, we're not going to have such confirmatory bias that's present in a case together with law enforcement misconduct. There's a number of safeguards that are in place today that, I would hope that such a case would not come to trial. Obviously, a prosecutor is obligated to ensure that there's probable cause to proceed, that there's enough evidence to proceed in a case. But beyond that, a prosecutor's obligation is to do justice, and that's to ensure the integrity of all the convictions that the office prosecutes.
So I know there's been a rise in the number of these conviction integrity units throughout the country. These are these teams of lawyers and investigators who are delving into an office's past cases. I know that there is not one of these in Asheville, but can you talk about this culture of DAs who are unwilling to look at old cases? How does that come about, and what can be done to counteract that?
Well, as you mentioned, I was a public defender for over a decade. And in 2014, I ran for the Office of District Attorney, and the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission had held hearings in in Buncombe County in regard to a set of cases here, and then found that several defendants were actually innocent. And I used that as a platform for my campaign. And in 2014, that resonated very powerfully with the electorate here in Buncombe County. North Carolina does have a statewide conviction integrity unit, the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission, and I don't want to be too glib about it, but I do view the work of the entire office to be pretty much our work from charge all the way through is to act as a conviction integrity unit. Now that being said, what with the growth in forensic evidence, I think about the cell phones, the cellular devices we all carry around, 64 gigabytes, even more in our pockets. Cases have grown far more complex over the years. And to do justice in a comprehensive way, I think it's time for the state of North Carolina to look at giving additional resources to district attorneys to review matters post-conviction, because the paradigm that we're in right now is kind of, we're prosecutors, we're obligated to prosecute cases, and I think the view from the legislature is once a case gets to sentence, our obligation is done, but that's not the case.
There are a number of points in which things can go wrong, and I'm curious for you. You spent more than 10 years as a public defender, we said, and there is a stereotype that some people are wrongly convicted because they have a bad public defender who's pushing them to take a deal or pushing them to plead guilty. Can you talk about false confessions, how they happen, and what can be done to change this?
Well, in regard to the work of public defenders, most public defenders are very conscientious specialists that basically are in criminal court day by day. And, you know, in regard to any case, I think it's incumbent on a public defender, a lawyer, defense counsel to develop a very strong relationship with the client to ensure that there's good communication, that, you know, reliable information is being relayed from the client to the defense team. And, you know, if you're a consumer of those services, you should be asking, you know, what kind of relationship do I have with my lawyer? How frequently do they come to talk to me? In regard to false confessions, that is more of perhaps a police or law enforcement question. And, that's perhaps another topic.
Is there a role that a district attorney's office can play in better monitoring potential instances of police misconduct or providing guidance in those situations?
Well, you got to look at the totality of the circumstances, and I think that what Mr. Coleman has laid out, in regard to the Finch case, is it shows the totality of the circumstances are that had misconduct, law enforcement misconduct. You had ID issues, manufactured evidence, this confirmatory bias right from the outset. A district attorney who's concerned about doing justice, and a defense lawyer who is looking at the evidence in a comprehensive way, should be working towards resolving the case short of trial. There's nothing more high stakes than a death case, especially where the attorney is placed in a situation where the client is claiming they're actually innocent and they don't have a means to support or verify the alibi that Mr. Finch had proposed.
I want to bring in one more guest to the conversation now. Seth Koch is a UNC professor specializing in the social history of criminal justice. His latest book is called Lethal State, A History of the Death Penalty in North Carolina. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So we've been talking about conviction rates, and I know that there's a statistic that Black people are 7 times more likely to be wrongly convicted of murder than white people. Can you put that statistic in context for us?
Well, it's shocking and completely in line with what we know about the history of the death penalty in North Carolina and of criminal convictions generally. I'll sort of shout a statistic back at you, which is that in the 1930s, when the head of the State Board of Pardons, Edwin Gill, who would go on to become state treasurer, when he was questioned at a conference about whether or not the death penalty in North Carolina was racist, he basically said, look how many people have received death sentences, African Americans, and have then had their sentences commuted. Don't you see that that means that we're not racist? And the explanation for the high number of commutations is, of course, there was a lot more errors and a lot more bias in cases involving Black defendants.
Is there a long history of exonerations in North Carolina? What do we know about it?
The short answer is no. The second answer is we don't know a great deal about it. And part of the reason we don't know much about it is because exonerations were much less common than simply commuting someone's sentence, reducing the sentence from a death penalty to life imprisonment following evidence of innocence. And so there were people who were able to demonstrate. And by the way, to someone outside the legal profession, the phrase actual innocence is so chilling because it really suggests the categories of guilt and innocence are much more sort of, you know, complex than I think we think about when we see, you know, courtroom drama on television. But the biases that were taking place in around the death penalty would often be resolved in this semi-formal way by the governor basically saying, okay, you're not going to get a death sentence, you'll get life imprisonment instead. And it was much rarer that they actually took the next step, which was actually pardoning someone, and then still rarer that they received any kind of restitution afterwards. So as both my fellow guests have said, we didn't have these kinds of institutions and infrastructures that were set up to address this systematically. It was much more informal. People would write letters to this guy, Edwin Gill, and he would make the call.
So, Todd, I'm curious from your perspective how you address racial bias in the justice system. I know that is a huge question, but with someone in your kind of role, what are the things that you can do on the front end to help turn things around?
Well, it's important to be conscious of it. Number one, we have had trainings. We participated in that to raise awareness. We humans, unfortunately, we're very judgmental creatures. We make, reflexive judgments implicitly, constantly. But increasingly, we don't have the kind of issues in our cases that Mr. Finch suffered from, that case suffered from, because thankfully we have, the proliferation of so much forensic science. In Mr. Finch's case, he had an alibi that perhaps, if we had cell phone records, that kind of technological record keeping, we would have been able to establish that, his alibi was supported. And it wouldn't have come down to sort of, the implicit racial bias type, things that certainly were a part of his case and made his case so difficult to defend.
James, in terms of the work of your clinic, do you agree that the system has changed in such a way that we don't have as many of these issues anymore?
Well, I disagree with that. Certainly the system has changed, but all that means is that the issues are different, not that they don't exist or that they have been eliminated. You asked about racial bias, for example. One of the problems that has plagued the criminal justice system forever is discrimination against black jurors. In a lot of these cases, these people who are convicted, innocent people who are convicted, are convicted by all white jurors or juries that have a single black juror. And that's done for a purpose. It is to eliminate anybody who might have empathy for the defendant. There's a recent case that the Supreme Court did, Flowers versus Mississippi, where the black defendant has been tried seven times, and each time either the prosecutor engaged in misconduct, or when he allowed more than one black jury to participate in the trial, there was a hung jury. So it shows that it makes a difference to have people who have experiences in the community where these crimes occur. But if you take them out of the case, then what you've done effectively is to lower the burden of proof for the prosecutors.
Todd, what guidance do you give your assistant DAs in their process of selecting a jury to try to eliminate bias?
We try to have candid conversations about it in jury selection. And what Mr. Coleman said is absolutely true. There are some constitutional protections in jury selection I believe we're post-Finch. I'm referencing the Batson decision. Mm-hmm. But that has always been kind of, it's been a feeble support. In Buncombe County, we're a county of about 6% African-American. So, frankly, we are very frequently challenged to have a diverse jury. But the studies do indicate that you're more likely to tend towards justice that you can have confidence in if you do have diversity on these panels.
Seth, as you, as a historian, look at how North Carolina has handled racial bias in the justice system, what do you see that is promising, and where do you think there's still a lot of room for improvement?
Well, I suppose if you want to feel optimistic, you just have to read a little bit of history, because it's grim. The criminal justice system, by and large, is set up in the post-Civil War American South in order to punish African-American men, largely, and in order to capture their labor and to use it in building our state infrastructure. We're the good road state, right? Bad men make good roads was the phrase that people used at the time to describe the convicts that were building our roads and our railroads. I suppose I'm not an optimist by nature, and the history makes me pessimistic because I feel what we've done is we have built these very important institutions around a core that was set up in a deeply racially biased fashion. And without addressing these fundamental questions, bias is, of course, one of them, implicit and explicit. People like Mr. Coleman are going to keep working, and these cases are going to keep coming up, and we'll be able to address them. But the question that I have is, how many more people are going to have to wait 40 years, to see their families outside the walls of a prison?
Todd, I only have 20 seconds. Are you hopeful?
Well, the work doesn't end. I don't mean to be pithy about it, but it's an extremely challenging time to be the district attorney in the American South. And to do justice. That's our obligation in each and every case, is to do justice.
James, in the 30 seconds I have remaining, for where you stand now, what keeps you hopeful moving forward? What are you paying attention to?
Well, what keeps me hopeful? I don't think that, if you look at the objective facts, you say, well, I can retire tomorrow and everything's going to be great. But I think in law schools around the country, we have students who've been involved in these kinds of cases and investigations, and I think they will make a difference when they become prosecutors and judges.
Wonderful. Thank you so much to James Coleman, the co-director of the Wrongful Convictions Clinic at Duke University's Law School, Seth Koch, a UNC professor specializing in the social history of criminal justice, and Todd M. Williams, the Buncombe County District Attorney. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we are going to learn about how a giant mural is connecting children across continents. Stay with us. I'm Anita Rao. This is The State of Things.